And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Yes, Dean Haglund, Lairness, you're there. I'm here. You're going to be heading to Warwick, Rhode Island this week.
So excited to get to Warwick, Rhode Island. Never been to Rhode Island. Have no idea what that state has to offer.
Providence is a cool town. I like Providence a lot, and I was looking forward to coming back. I was going to be joining you. We were going to be showing Truth Is Out There. You will still be doing this. You'll still be answering questions. We won't be turning those questions into a podcast, I guess, because the kid here is bailing on the trip.
Damn it. What the hell? That sucks.
Now, some people might recall, and when I say some people, I mean people who are around me the wedding weekend, that I was complaining of how what I assumed to be cataracts were affecting my vision.
Right.
For example, it was making driving a 50-50 proposition. I mean, literally a 50-50 proposition, because I couldn't read street signs because everything looked backlit to me. So when I went to LAX from the cell phone waiting lot to pick up John and Kelly Lawler, I couldn't see the signs, which way was arrival, which way was departure. I had literally a 50-50 chance of getting it right.
Good Lord.
And I got it wrong. I went to departures rather than arrivals. And because it was my wedding weekend, everything worked out in my favor. So even going to departures rather than arrivals played great. Because it was the beginning of a three-day weekend, arrivals was packed. Departures was surprisingly empty. So we got in and out of that airport fast by just having them come upstairs. So I was literally operating by faith, if not by sight. And it was working great. But I mean, my driving, which, as you know, raises certain questions under the best of circumstances.
Right.
Truly was death defying at that point because of my eyes.
God.
And John and Kelly got such a wrong impression of L.A. And this is a bizarre thing. We haven't talked about this. Somehow, all of the city knew that I was getting married that weekend, because what John and Kelly witnessed was me making illegal, dangerous maneuver after illegal, dangerous maneuver, cutting people off across four lanes of traffic on Florence Boulevard, for example, and no one honking at me. No one, not once. And John and Kelly said, oh, my God, in Los Angeles, nobody uses their horns. In New York, drivers get angry and use their horns, which, as you know, in L.A., of course, is what people do. They lay on their horns all the time. They use their horns just to let you know that you might do something tomorrow that's going to make them angry.
That's right.
And nobody did. And then I'm making illegal U-turns right in front of cops, and they're just kind of waving at me. It was like I had free run of this city because everybody knew I was getting married.
Well, they listened to the podcast.
Maybe. I guess so. And then, of course, the night of the wedding, going downtown to the Nomad Hotel for the wedding, and then in the days thereafter, of course, everyone's honking at me because the back of the car says just married, and now people honk for a totally different reason, which is to tell you how happy they are for you.
Aww. See?
But
that's lovely.
But that eyesight, which led to such a charming story, has gotten really bad. It's like even at home, work goes so slowly. I can't read anything. I can't see. I can't see backlit computer screens. I need to have my reading glasses on, my face up close to them.
Are you watching movies on the big screen?
The font has to be very high and in bold, and I've got my magnifying glass. No, I'm not going to movies, but mostly because going out is so problematic.
Good Lord.
And it's the brighter the environment, the blinder I am. It's all milky white, cloudy yeah. white. The cool thing is in the middle of the night with no lights on, I can see clearly. It's like my built-in night vision is my superhero power I never wanted. but it is really bad. And my suspicion is cataracts. Recently, lights are showing halos, which is a big sign of cataracts. And I buckled under, Dean, and even after it was a New Year's resolution for many years, I finally, after 17 years, went and saw a doctor, and she saw me, and which is more important because I really couldn't see her. But there is no shortage of worry about, as you said before the show, how did it get so bad so quickly?
Yeah.
But tracing back my eyesight, when I started editing Truth Is Out There in 2009. I didn't need that was about the time I first got prescription glasses, reading glasses. Reading was starting to cause a little bit of a problem.
Right.
But in short order, I started needing my reading glasses for distance as well. And that's rare, especially for somebody hitting 40. It's not rare for someone hitting 40 to need reading glasses. But for both. And then my prescriptions were changing radically and dramatically. And last summer made another big leap in my reading glass prescription. Like I bypassed several prescription levels. And so it's possible that I've actually had cataracts going on a decade.
Holy shit. That's a long time. So what did the doctor say? Said, indeed, you do have cataracts.
Well, that probably. Now, the doctor's not an ophthalmologist. The doctor needs to make the optometrist told me to see the ophthalmologist. The optometrist was optimistic that the ophthalmologist would see me. And
But that ophthalmologist was not optimistic.
Insurance being what it is, I had to go to my primary care provider first to get the referral for the ophthalmologist, which meant introducing myself for the first time to my primary care provider, who has been my primary care provider unbeknownst to her for 6 years. She was actually quite concerned. It was actually very touching that she made an emotional connection to my case right off the bat. And so she was relieved as I told her more of the symptoms and explained everything that it is indeed cataracts. But the concern is I'm young to have cataracts this advanced. And she said, why do you seem happy? I said, you called me young. Because in this condition, 50 is very young. So,
right. So, 50 is the new 40 for cataracts.
I've always found communities in which I am the kid in the room, and I'm still doing it. That's the beauty.
So, but now it's a simple surgical procedure, isn't it?
Well, so now because of the concern though about why would I develop these so early? For example, tonight I get to go and get an MRI on my orbits. I get a brain scan done.
Wow. Excellent.
Yeah,
those are fun.
Yeah, and so I've had to have several different people covering their asses calling me to find out you're not claustrophobic, are you? I said, you know what gives me a feeling of claustrophobia? And they said, what? I said, several people calling me asking me the same question always makes me feel very claustrophobic.
I really like MRIs. I find them very soothing. Comforting. A lot of people get freaked out by the magnetic buzz, but I find that whole thing in a tiny, being in a little sort of contained hole. Oh my God. Hugged by a giant magnet.
These people who are bothered by the magnetic buzz are obviously not listeners of this podcast, who are a show that is frequently accompanied by a magnetic buzz. So metaphorically and literally.
Right.
So anyway, so that's what's going on. And it really just occurred to me this morning. One, when they were calling and saying, we can get you into late night appointment tonight for this, which means you can get to the ophthalmologist, I would imagine, faster. I'm just staying in town until all this gets done. And then also, travel. If something goes wrong, especially, it just feels so dramatically unsafe. And me on Saturday morning at the New York Port Authority, getting on altogether the wrong bus, not ending up in Providence at all. Like,
getting out of North Carolina for some reason.
Exactly.
Yeah. I get it.
That feels like the smarter thing to do. Working smarter seems like the right thing to do. But you're right. It's a procedure where they... from what I understand, they surgically replace the lenses in your eye.
I thought they sonically broke up the cataract, sucked it out of the lens.
I've heard they are replacing the lens, and what that means is I can have one of my vision issues corrected.
Right. Probably all of them, I would think.
No, I think you still, that does not look, neither of us are doctors. We're both just pissing in the wind here, but I
did pre-med.
I do think, I mean, look, you've witnessed an autopsy in the X-Files, so you have more hands-on experience, but I did audiovisual work at a neuroscience conference that involved operating on severed human heads, so maybe we are even. But what my understanding is, and certainly I'll report back to you as I get more information, is that they can correct one or the other. They can correct for the distance, or they can correct for the nearsighted, the reading and whatnot, but they can't correct for both.
Right. Damn it.
That's all right. I mean, that's all right. Reading glasses, that's no problem at all. But I mean, it would be great if I could see at distance without needing glasses on, especially because I imagine one of the things, certainly I doubt a cause of cataracts, but ever since I started wearing glasses and needing them for distance, I stopped wearing sunglasses ever. And that was not good for my eyes, especially on 5 and 10,000 mile drives through the southwestern United States in the middle of summer.
You didn't wear sunglasses?
Never. Not once. Not one moment.
That would do it right there. Holy.
I burnt my eyeballs out.
Oh, you're Ray Milland in Man with the X-Ray Eyes. Do you remember that one?
No.
The Roger Corman, 1961, and he invents these drops that give him X-ray vision so he can see, and he goes to Vegas to start gambling because he can see the cards coming up, and then he keeps putting it in till all he can see is girders and ropes with no structures hanging from them, and he gets to, and here's spoiler alert, out in the middle of the desert, there's a religious revival, and he comes up and the crowd yells for him to pluck out his eyes, and he yanks them out with a dramatic close-up of Ray Milland's eyeless head painted red.
Oh my God, that sounds like a good one.
It is a fantastic. I love Man with the X-Ray Eyes.
All right. I'm going to have to check that out. All right. That's our Roger Corman recommendation of the day.
Totally. I think you now can more identify to that than ever before.
Roger Corman, recommendation of the day is a great. In fact, we could do every, like a 2-minute, 3-minute podcast daily in addition to our weekly show that is just the Roger Corman recommendation.
The Roger Corman recommendation. Yeah.
All right.
Could totally do that.
It's an interstitial for the Blog Talk Radio Network. hey, you know, there was some good news in the wake of the Notre Dame fire that I thought was cool, which was that, did you see the story about all the thousands of bees that survived?
I did not see that story. So, that sounds like a good story.
Apparently they kept bees in the cathedral, and these bees survived.
What?
And so there's... I love any story that involves bees surviving, because usually stories are about how bees are dying out.
Right. So this is interesting. Does that mean there is a Notre Dame honey, that an urban honey from the Church of Notre Dame? I bet that's delicious.
You went with a different place. I just thought about how all of humankind relies on bees surviving for our very survival. But
well, there's that. Yes, but, cross-pollination. But I would like to taste the honey.
Well, now we have more. So many research assignments are coming out of this show.
Fly to Paris, get the honey.
You know, one of the most... look, it's all interesting. I would don't kid yourself for a minute. I wouldn't include anything in part two of The Truth Is Out There that isn't fascinating. One of the most interesting things is Andrew Goff. I think it's pronounced Goff, G-O-U-G-H. Andrew Goff, mm-hmm. wonderful writer and presenter. Talking about bees is a really fascinating thing. Bees in mythology and symbolism and in secret societies and... the religious ramifications of bees. It's really good stuff.
Wow. Yeah. I want to see that.
Yeah. You might have seen some clips of that this weekend in Warwick, Rhode Island, if I'd brought them.
Great.
But you're on.
So
your
there's
own.
No way I could show the 20-minute teaser clip.
Yeah, now we had to, originally we had too much. We had a movie, we had a teaser clip, we had a whole live podcast we were going to do. Now you're stuck just having somebody do your arms.
I don't know if I'm doing a show, actually. I think it's...
Oh, it's starting to seem like you are.
It does, doesn't it?
Oh, my God. The Q&A. Oh, my God, that would be so funny. Because you're going to get the same questions you always do. So just to mix it up, pick someone to be your arms in the lab coat during the Q&A.
Yeah, your question. You, sir, you. I'm looking at you, but I'm pointing over there. That's plastic.
You know, we have Hollywood as part of this show's name, and mm-hmm. It seems to me that we should talk about the latest Hollywood news, and we really haven't been for a couple weeks, but the Writers Guild of America... negotiations with the talent agents utterly broke down.
Yeah, went south, I would say, more than broke down.
And the deadlines passed, and writers who wish to remain in the guild, in their union, cannot be represented by agents who have not signed with the Writers Guild. And the big piece of it, there's other issues as well, but the big piece of it is that the Writers Guild demands a certain code of conduct be followed by all agencies. And one of the big issues in this is transparency on information. That the union has the right to review the contract that an agent negotiates for their client. And the agents are saying, no, this is, everything in show business now, like in the world, is non-disclosure agreement, non-circumvention, non-disclosure.
NDA.
Yeah, and we'd be violating those. We would never get these deals. And the Writers Guild is rightly calling bullshit on that, because these are the same agencies who represent sports stars. And when sports stars have their contracts negotiated, before those contracts can be ratified, the players' union has to review all the terms on it. The league has to review all the terms on it before that contract can be ratified. And the whole reason for this, in case people, because I know it's open season, has been for a long time on unions, and like with any bureaucracy, there are reasons to distrust and have problems with unions and guilds. But the whole point of it is that it shouldn't be on the individual to review whether or not those terms of that contract are fair according to the labor standard that producers and the guild agreed to.
Correct. Because who's got that kind of... the individual, you don't even know. How are you doing that research? You should be writing, not being a lawyer.
Yeah, and if you do see something that is unfair, that is unsafe, that it's like an actor, right?
Yeah.
An actor should never be in a position of showing up on the set and having to be the voice of standing up for their own physical safety. They
right.
are there to do a job, and there should be other people whose responsibility is to ensure the standard physical safety precautions are in place.
Right.
It's their job to do that.
Exactly.
And so it's not that the writers are necessarily being put in a potentially physically dangerous situation, a la actors, but the analogy holds, which is your job is to be a writer. Your job is not to interpret the legality of the work situation.
Right. So what is the pushback, though, from the agencies because they are packaging these deals, because they're offering sweetheart discounts to certain things? They don't want those contracts to be shown? Is that the deal?
I think it's I think packaging is a big part of it. I think you you're calling back to sort of the original sin to me, which actually involves the Screen Actors Guild. When the Screen Actors Guild had to really make a decision citing between agents or managers.
When right, it came, remember that fight?
Yeah, when it came to kind of negotiating deals. And
yeah.
and they came down squarely on the side of agents. Franchised agents will be the only ones who are legally allowed to negotiate deals for actors, right. not their managers. And
right.
the reason was because they feared that managers would serve as producers.
Yes.
As many managers do. And,
yeah.
and indeed, SAG's decision freed up managers to act as producers. Why not
exactly.
then? There's no conflict of interest then. We may as well do that. And many managers became famous top flight producers.
Brad Gray.
But agencies as a whole started packaging from different divisions and basically becoming production companies.
Right. Yes. And that became a tricky thing. And there was a way they did that by opening an arm of CAA that is a production arm, not necessarily the agency.
Well, I think they all have, right? William Morris Endeavor, ICM. Yeah. So many had indie labels, and they worked as sales agents. And yeah, it more than ever, you really do need your union reviewing contracts to make sure that no one is putting any artist in a position of, yeah, we're not going to live up to the terms of the ratified deal. Take the job or leave it.
Yeah, right.
Because almost always someone's going to say, well, I'll take it. I mean,
what's your option?
A job at 80% of what I'm supposed to be making is better than no job at $0.
Yes.
And that's how people get away with things, right? I mean,
yeah.
So you need to have leverage, and your leverage comes in the form of your union, of your team. At one point, it came in the form of your agents, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your agents
yep.
would protect your best interest. And they would want to protect your best interests, fighting tooth and nail for you against the producers and the studios, because if they had your best interest and fought for you, not only would you stay with them, but they would develop a reputation as someone who fights for the creative people they represent, and everyone wants to sign with them. It was good business to do it. But now, the name of the game with an agency is how much can you get made?
Right.
There's nothing per se wrong with that, provided the people involved have a level of protection. So that's what the Writers Guild have done. And that's why I think you'll find, even if you find people who are not in favor of how the Writers Guild has handled this, you find no one in favor, even those very people who have misgivings about the Writers Guild, you find no one who says, I side with the talent agents.
Right. Yeah. I know. But then the call out to have all writers in the guild fire their agents as the next negotiating ploy. So that
I don't think it was a negotiating ploy. I think that's a mischaracterization. The contract had long since expired.
Yeah.
And the Writers Guild allowed it to stay in effect as a good faith effort to negotiate. Now, whether you believe that or not, but I do think the point is it had expired. And finally, they said, look, we will only extend this so long. And what it means is it's no different than any other kind of labor situation, right? If the producers will not sign a labor agreement, then at some point, the labor has to walk or they are working illegally.
Right.
And,
well, that's the point.
And that was the case here. And it was a big deal because a lot of showrunners who are working right now, guess what, agencies? You get no percentage.
Right, yeah.
That deal is null and void, and good luck getting back money owed to you.
Well, this is the thing, too, right? I mean, there's other writers that I was reading on my Facebook feed that were just... They were doing it. They were firing their agent, but they were crap in their pants going, you know, that's been a 20-year relationship that we've developed. And now I'm firing this guy. And, you know, the future of how do I find work? What is going to happen? Must be just hair-raising.
And I will point out again, from what I understand, the Writers Guild is, you know, continuing to work and allow... agencies to represent their writers if those agencies sign this code of conduct. And I don't think there's anything wrong with them expecting it to be a standard code of conduct. But the biggest agencies are the ones that have a problem with it. They feel that they should not be held to the same code of conduct as smaller agencies. And I would say you're right. You should be held to a much stricter code of conduct, because you have a lot more to hide.
Right. Yeah. Holy shit. So now what's the upshot? I mean,
what I love is the idea that what about writers who are also directors or also actors, right? Hyphenates.
Yeah.
If your literary is in the same agency as represents you as a director or as an actor, that's not uncomfortable.
Right. Yeah. That's hard to walk around that one.
These are
one of those
shifts, yeah. Though, right? I mean, these are existential shifts, and they're exciting kind of conversations. I mean, think about, Dean, it wasn't that long ago, right? It's less than 100 years. It's 80 years ago that Screen Actors Guild and other guilds are being formed.
Right.
And the show business is totally different than it was then. And, yeah. We're going to see a shift in all of this and how everything gets negotiated and how things get made. And
right.
I think that's all right. We should expect major shifts. Yeah.
Yeah. Because how we consume entertainment, how we all, you know, what is entertainment? All of that has so changed. So why not these contracts from the 1970s? Get rewritten from top to bottom.
I love it. That's entertainment. I want to do a new version. Like, we'll write new lyrics to That's Entertainment, you know,
right?
Involving contract negotiation.
Oh, I can see that being a hit. Everybody loves that.
Hey, I wanted to talk about one celebrity death. And it involves television. And so let's do that, shall we?
Let's do that.
Celebrity deaths.
Georgia Engel died at 70 years of age. And I must tell you, I was shocked to realize how young she was, because it meant that when she was co-starring on the Mary Tyler Moore Show as Ted Baxter's wife, Georgia Engel, was in her 20s.
Wow. That's amazing.
Two Emmy nominations as Georgette Baxter, as such a, you know, good friend of Mary Richards on the show. Like everyone on that show, so indelible. I mean, has there ever been a show that's been more perfectly cast? I mean,
no.
But in such a wide variety of characters, I mean, unbelievable, huh?
Really? I mean, you think about also how that the characters themselves seem so lived in. They weren't, you know, that everybody was that character so deeply. It was very odd.
And although there's a big age difference then between Ted Knight's Ted Baxter and Georgia Engel's Georgette Baxter. It's so funny how everybody's first name is like their character's first name. That marriage actually made sense on that show too.
It was
really well thought out, and the chemistry so great. She got two Emmy nominations for that. She received another three Emmy nominations back in the 90s for her role as Pat McDougall on Everybody Loves Raymond.
Her
last recurring role was alongside Betty White on Hot in Cleveland.
That's right. I watched that.
So, a fixture in top-notch television comedy for several decades, and again, in her 20s, mixing it up with kind of the... you've heard me refer to Veep and that cast on Veep as being like an all-star team of comedy.
Right.
And certainly Mary Tyler Moore was an all-star team of comedic performers, and she was maybe the youngest one on there.
Wow, that's amazing. That's a shock, all right.
So 70 years of age, Georgia Engel. Also young, too young to really have the cataracts, and certainly too young to be fighting for his life after a massive stroke. Oscar-nominated filmmaker John Singleton. Who wrote and directed, got nominations from the Academy for both of those activities, for his debut film, Boys in the Hood, back in 91. He's only 51 years of age.
Now, this is the second stroke of a 50-year-old in the news after Luke Perry. Is there water contamination? What's going on?
And they're more dangerous. I mean, I have read this because, you know, again, the kid here is 50. And so it was good, by the way, to go to the doctor and get, you know, all the vitals done and get the blood tests and all those kind of things. And, hearing the phrase, you know, Swiss watch in relationship to my heart. I think it was in relationship to my heart. I don't know. I have no idea.
Are you supposed to go to Switzerland? Maybe one of the two.
He's Swiss. Watch. Okay. But I've been reading about how it's so much more dangerous, so much more deadly strokes in younger, healthier people.
So weird. You would think you would have the elasticity still to bounce back from such a thing.
But indeed, it's exactly the opposite.
You are not elastic.
Yeah, I guess, what is it? That the brain has more and more room to swell, and the swelling continues more and more, I guess, is what it is. Or it's the opposite of that. Yeah, but whatever it is, like being younger and healthier and stronger means that if you suffer something like this, you're really... look what happened with Luke Perry. I mean, in the immediate aftermath, he was responsive. He was fine. It seemed like he had stroke-like symptoms, but not a full stroke. He wasn't slurring. Yeah. He wasn't...
He called the ambulance himself, didn't he?
Yeah, and in the days that followed, then it just got worse and worse. And he was in medical care, and there was nothing that they could do. So really scary. Really, really scary.
Yeah. So John Singleton.
Yeah, John Singleton, 51 years of age, which means he was 23 when Boys in the Hood comes out.
Right. And he was a UCLA former grad.
USC.
Too, wasn't he?
USC.
Like, oh, he was USC.
Yeah.
I think the story I read that when Sean Penn did the gangster movie Colors.
Colors. Nightmare Walking, Psychopath Talking, Colors.
Colors. Yeah.
Okay.
John Singleton was so outraged at the at that movie that he began calling out the producers when they showed it at USC, walking down the aisle, swearing to them upside and down the other. And that rage fueled him to do Boys in the Hood.
Hmm. Okay.
Well, did you never hear that story?
I felt that way about John Singleton's remake of Shaft. Okay. but Singleton, that makes sense because as I remember it, the screenplay was part of his thesis.
Right.
His PhD, you know, or his master's thesis there in screenwriting at USC.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, everything started at USC as a reaction to what filmmaking was at that time.
You know, it is interesting. That movie is no less great than it was when it came out. It still packs a wallop. And
yeah.
Yet, I don't know. There's something about the fact that his career never lived up to that first film that takes the bloom off that first film a little bit.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's hard if you're coming at a creative process from rage and then to have a career that fuels that blossoms from your reaction to things. When you become the establishment, it becomes hard to be angry at yourself to then have a creative process come out.
Well, and also there might be something to you told a story that you knew. That you knew very
right.
Well, and so how do you do that again?
Yes, the Margaret Mitchell phenomena.
At 23, also,
yeah.
You know, and you become that successful that fast, are you now closed off from getting the kind of experience that you need to be able to continue to tell stories that you know?
Right, that will resonate, of course.
And, well, one could say, but he doesn't have to direct other, I mean, he doesn't have to write. Other people could write, and he could direct those things, right?
Right.
But even though he directed that film exceptionally well, he was given a wonderful script that he happened to write to do it.
Right.
And that doesn't necessarily mean that he was equipped to interpret somebody else's work then. So it's a really tricky thing because we also don't develop this, you know, we may have multiple skills, but they don't all develop at the same pace.
That's true, eh?
So,
wow. I'm going to have to rewatch Boys in the Hood now.
Boys in the Hood. Remember, it's got a Z and then an N. We want you to, you know, we want
right.
you to spell it correctly because there are so many knockoffs and so many cheap... you know, foreign release only parodies of things that we don't want you to.
Yeah, no, God forbid.
Yeah, okay. Our old friend Roman Polanski is back in the news.
What?
And, this is fun. It's been so long. Let's have a lawsuit of the week.
Yay!
The Chill Pack Hollywood lawsuit of the week.
Roman Polanski is suing the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences.
Wow.
For his ouster. They canceled his membership in the Academy in the wake of Me Too and Time's Up, citing his 1978 rape of a 13-year-old girl for which he was convicted in absentia when he fled the country.
Right.
And he's suing them. And I'm not quite sure what grounds he has for such a lawsuit.
Well, I mean, if it's wrongful dismissal, if it's not explicit in the charter that if you are, you know, does the Academy Charter specifically say any sexual deviant pedophile is not a member of this Academy? You know, I could see... that would be a case of wrongful dismissal because normally that has to be printed out in an HR document of some sort so that you have the grounds to kick somebody out of a corporation, business, of you know, any sort of job has these things laid out specifically so that this kind of wrongful dismissal lawsuit can't come back on you.
You know, and if so, then I would say, or, you know, if that's true, if that's all they had as a way to be able to, if the charter didn't allow for it, if the rules didn't allow for voting someone out, then I would say, okay, you know, you bite the bullet, you let him back in, you apologize, and then you have a new rule, which is all members yeah. need to attend one meeting a year in the legal jurisdiction of Los Angeles County.
Hey, that's a good one.
So do you want to be a member? Because, you know, there's still a warrant out for you.
Exactly. Think of that.
The part that is astonishing to me is, why is he suing? I mean, what, you know, first of all, does he so desperately want to be a member of a group that doesn't want him? And what is it that he's fighting? I mean, he got away with it.
Yeah.
He got away with it. He's, yes, he hated France more than any other country on the globe. And ironically, that's, and if people don't believe me, watch The Tenant. France is the country he hated the most, having fled the Nazis, having witnessed France's relationship to the purge of Jews under Nazi Germany. There's no country he hated more, and that's the country that gives him safe harbor and where he spent his adult life. That said, he's had a career, he's had fame, he's had wealth, he's been able to keep making movies, starring in plays, so it all worked out for him.
Right.
In the wake of what he did, and indeed, by all accounts, he's been allowed to continue to be a sexual predator.
Right. Yeah, he hasn't actually mended his ways in any way or learned from his mistake, it seems.
So what is it? Why fight this fight? What's motivating him to... What would motivate someone to do it? To become ever more hated? Because there's... Because he could win. Sure, he could win reinstatement in the Academy. But does he really need the screeners that badly?
he's trying to save money.
Because he doesn't go. He's never going to be nominated again.
Right. Right.
What does it matter? And all this does is dredge up all the horrible things about him again in the press, in public.
So he's either getting some bad advice or he's at that age where he's sort of the memory of time gone past. You would think, oh, it's not that bad. It wasn't that bad. So he's somehow justified it perhaps in his head that his crimes were minimal, and that the reaction was overblown, and now he wants not, you know, I don't think it'll amend anything, but it would trying to clear his name, as it were.
There is this kind of thing that has taken over different walks of our life, this energetic of a certain type of older man who has victimized people throughout his life and who feels like such a victim as he feels the walls closing in.
Right.
I'm going to leave that metaphor there, but we have several examples of this. The powerful man who just behaves in this whiny, victimized way after horrible things that they've committed.
Yeah.
And we've seen it again and again in different... I mean, Bill Cosby is an example of this. Polanski, there are political examples when I'm dancing around.
Right.
So I don't know what... it's very bizarre. They got away with it for so long, got everything that you could possibly get, and they're the ones that are the whiny, needy victims at the end of it.
Well, and this is the case of narcissism, which we see rise its head again and again, but it seems to come up more. I guess now we know what narcissistic tendencies look like, and the narcissistic personality is a little easier to spot as opposed to someone who seems like incredibly dynamic, but in fact has terrible consequences when you get to them in a situation, shall we say. So I think that that is one of the symptoms, one of the aspects of a narcissistic personality is the victimhood of themselves, even though they victimize so many others.
I'm feeling very triggered by what you said.
I don't because know. You're narcissistic?
But enough about me. What do you think of me so far? Okay, so, Dean Haglund, you're back in the States now.
I am. Look at me. Full on in the Americas.
You're the Motor City Madman. I'm curious how this has affected your television viewing.
Oddly enough, we subscribe to Acorn TV, which is many BBC and Australian TV shows, because there is aspects of the last 4 years of living in Australia that we do miss, that we assuage by watching Australian and New Zealand police dramas.
Oh my God, so that's what you've been watching?
Yeah, well, yeah, there's some other crap as well that we're plowing through. A werewolf show out of Toronto called Bitten. That's Dynasty for Werewolves. That's terrible. That one. Oh my God. I think we had to pause that one. What else is on the list? Terribly, some people think is cheesy. I find it slightly delightful. The Murdoch Mysteries, also turn of the century Toronto with a inventive police detective, William Murdoch, solving crimes around 1906 to 1909 in Toronto. That's we watch. So yeah, there's a lot of cheese and a lot of Australian and BBC dramas.
Now you're a stone's throw away from there. When do we start to meet with some of these Toronto casting people to get Dean Haglund in some of these cheesy turn of the century murder mysteries?
It's happening. It turns out that the union rule requires that a lot of these productions are so cheap, they can't afford to put you up in a hotel. So you have to find your own place to live.
You have to be local hire.
Local hire. And so my one connect to Toronto has since moved. So that spare bedroom I had is gone. So now I'm on the search again for a place to crash in Toronto so I can be on Murdoch Mysteries. That seems rather pathetic, doesn't it? Now that I say it out loud.
Now, how far away is Toronto from?
Well, I did it. Public transit. Get this. I did the Q line, the new streetcar through Detroit, all the way downtown. The $5 bus that takes you through the 1931 tunnel under the Detroit River, that comes out on the Windsor side, and then a Windsor walk to the VIA train station for a 3-hour train ride into Toronto. So technically 4 hours by rail and bus, or an hour and a half, but you still have to be at the airport 2 hours early and you are flying. But it's quick. It's 4 hours away. LA is to Vegas.
Okay. All right. So driving time would be similar.
Similar, yes.
All right.
Yeah, I haven't driven it yet.
So it is too far to be able to be in Detroit and act. It's too much of a commute.
Well, yeah, there's only 3 trains a day to Windsor from Toronto. So if you are shooting a bit late, say, or maybe you screw up your lines and you miss that train, that's a lot of pressure on the actor to get his cues right. You know what I'm saying?
All right.
It's made a process.
Now, many of these shows I know you enjoy on streaming platforms. I don't have to tell you, streaming has changed everything.
Yes.
And we talked about how Disney streaming is going to upset that apple cart even more. And,
right.
Or straighten out the apple cart, quite frankly, it might, because everybody's been waiting for the 800-pound gorilla to show up.
Right.
And it's Disney Plus. But the news this week was about how Song of the South will not be available on streaming at any point. They will not re-release this movie in any way, shape, or form. And they are re-editing Dumbo to take out the crows.
Oh.
Because of racial insensitivity in both of these cases.
Right.
And I have misgivings about both these things.
Yeah, it's tough, isn't it? I mean, by erasing your past, do you then fall victim to repeating it? That's also the worry.
And is there nothing of redeeming value in these pieces, in the watching of this? I mean, we do not bury Birth of a Nation. Birth of a Nation is still studied. It's historical import, both as a document of racism, a document of the times, mm-hmm. also as a stepping stone in the development of cinematic language.
Right. Edit the using editing to build dramatic tension.
These require it to stay available for study and for pillory, honestly, yeah. too. And so I don't understand.
It's the medium and the message, right? This is a Marshall McLuhan argument now, because the medium is the message. Therefore, if you realize historically Birth of the Nation then reinvigorated the Ku Klux Klan so that its ranks swelled 60,000 members in a period of just 10 months with the screening of this film and the popularity of it, you can see where one can maybe confuse the medium and studying the medium and getting the message also mixed in, unfortunately.
Yeah, I feel like there's got to be some. I mean, it's a streaming service where people are accessing these materials. I mean, instead of re-editing, instead of burying, how about adding thoughtful discussion, introduction that can't be skipped over?
Right.
Contextualizing these things, using it as a teaching opportunity. Also, how about changing the rating on it? Maybe these aren't G. Maybe these are PG-13, and it requires the viewing. There is no, you know how like sometimes you'll get something on demand and it'll say, you know, fast forwarding might be disabled for this on-demand program because they don't want you to fast-forward through the commercials. Well,
right.
Certainly they could do that through an introduction then. You know, if there is some kind of introductory material, there's an opportunity, I think, that is being missed, and that troubles me.
Well, and then, so this is also the woman who's saying the national anthem for some sports team, that they're stopping her because one of her 1930s, 40s albums had racial slur songs in it that are offensive. And it wasn't her national anthem, which was the good luck charm of this, I think it's Philadelphia sports team. And I don't remember all the details, but it is this, again, this reverse where you see somebody of the time, right? You think about minstrel shows at the turn of the century, that everybody, this was the form of American entertainment. So yeah, there's now Wilson in blackface in the first talkie. Do you remove that as well?
Or do you ignore Jolson altogether because of that he did that? Or you know, I mean, this is, we sound a lot like Polanski right now. You kick me out of you kick me out of the academy because of One Wild Party 40 years ago.
I guess, you know what? So there you go. You just said, what's Polanski's motivation?
But,
perhaps it is this uneasiness.
But I do think that specifically, we're not even right now talking about people. We're talking about the, you know, the works themselves.
Right.
And do we just burn them, or do we learn from them and celebrate what we can about them, including how we can look at these with a different eye and a different perspective? So I'm disappointed. Obviously, the more we talk about this stuff, I think the better it is. The more it's on the table, the better it is. Mm-hmm. And it's dangerous when it's not. It's dangerous when we sanitize it. So that's...
Well, and this is, you know what? You asked what we were streaming over there on Prime Video. It's Laugh-In, the 1968 revolutionary one-hour TV comedy on NBC with Dick Martin and Rowan and Martin, and Goldie Hawn and all that. Wow. You watch that now. You see those jokes in there. Holy smokes. Flip Wilson as a guest star, and he was a very funny comedian with his own show. The stuff they're doing, the sexism, the racism, the implied homophobia, all through that stuff is so dated now and so shocking that I would think if more people were watching the same thing I were watching, there'd be a lot more people up in arms about stuff that's out there. Now, that said, do you stop Laugh-In from being streamed? I mean, it was a groundbreaking TV show in the 1960s of the counterculture revolution.
I will say comedy is going through massive upheaval. I watched this week the Razzie award-winning film for worst film of the year. Many critics had it as the worst film of the year. Got dreadful reviews. Was a huge bomb. Written and directed by Etten Cohen. Holmes and Watson, starring Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly. John C. Reilly wins a Golden Razzie for Worst Supporting Actor of the Year for this. And I'm just scratching my head about that.
Why?
Well,
did you laugh at this?
So I did watch Far and Away, the worst film of the year, but it was Aquaman. It wasn't Holmes and Watson. Aquaman, which made $1.2 billion and everybody loved, and even the critics were like, kind of like, this is pretty cool. And that's just a dreadful, dreadful work. And Holmes and Watson isn't that bad. And really? what is interesting about it, especially contextually, semi-pro, Talladega Nights, what was that one about figure skating that Will Ferrell did? Blades of Glory.
Oh, yeah.
These were hits that got mixed reviews. Will Ferrell movies are always going to get mixed reviews.
Yeah.
Even Anchorman, which is a true classic of screen comedy, I believe, mixed reviews because it's a Will Ferrell movie and it's broad comedy. And we know that broad comedy is not always traditionally embraced by contemporary critics at the time the film is released. That has always been true for comedic performers throughout the years. But this is a film. The one difference I will say is that this is a broad comedy that doesn't have a specific contemporary target. And most broad comedies now, from Bridesmaids to those earlier Will Ferrell movies I'm talking about, have specific contemporary targets. This doesn't have one. This is spoofing Holmes and Watson movies, Sherlock Holmes. So it really actually feels like a Mel Brooks movie. It really is a Mel Brooks movie. It's very much like Gene Wilder's attempt at a Mel Brooks movie, The Adventure of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother. But that said, it's not a particularly bad Mel Brooks movie, Holmes and Watson. And I read the reviews and I read the user reviews, and they're all blanket statements. Will Ferrell's not funny. Broad comedy's not funny. Slapstick's not comedy. Not funny. And period pieces are not funny. And this is like this general groupthink that we've now accepted these things aren't funny. And I guess we go through that from time to time. But it disappoints me because, you know, some Mel Brooks movies are really, really funny.
Right.
And I
know, right?
And I feel like they're going to be relegated to the dustbin of history when people my age have shuffled off our mortal coil.
Well, it takes a new appreciation, I think. I mean, you think about Mack Sennett. As soon as sound came in, all Mack Sennett comedies, the Keystone Cops, all of that sort of thing, were considered not just old-fashioned, but terribly unfunny. What was everybody laughing about? Marx Brothers, all of these, Laurel and Hardy, even with their verbal, everybody wanted verbal comedy right away as soon as you had sound. So I think there's a technological phenomena, again, the way we consume entertainment, the way we stream it, the way our attention span has shifted, that now requires comedy to be slightly different. And I would think if you don't know your source material, if you've never seen a Sherlock Holmes original Basil Rathbone thing, then you're not going to get the parody of it. And yeah, that's always the problem with parodies, right?
Yeah.
So you don't have a common language anymore. Like for the longest time, all comedians did jokes about commercials because everybody saw the same bloody commercial. And so you could do, just make fun of commercials because everybody saw them. Well, now you can't do that. So if you see a commercial, you have to actually explain it, like the way The Daily Show did. The Daily Show had to explain what was going on, then make fun of it. That's why it was actually everybody getting their news. And well, same with Stephen Colbert, because they have to explain the gag to make fun of it.
And there was a time when both the people on the left and the right politically could laugh at it, that right, everybody could be in on the joke. But yeah, you're right. Like what we want is things that divide us. And so the very nature of comedy, which is at its best something that can get all of us laughing and looking at things differently, we want it to reinforce how we already look at it.
Right. And that sort of started all the way back with the rednecks of comedy, with you're a redneck when, and all that sort of thing. That became this sort of cultural divide of Larry the Cable Guy, all those guys doing that sort of thing and reinforcing a cultural divide by having comedians cater to it, like actually design their act specifically to draw a line between it.
Yeah, and so it's why we can't have comedy anymore. We need to have our comedy blended in with other forms now, I feel.
Or you do an improv comedy show, at which point you're bringing people up and whatever their stripe is. I think that's why improv is now getting more traction than
that's true. I was shocked seeing this Aquaman. I wasn't sure for the first 45 minutes if it was as bad as I thought. Look, I may be wrong. I may have spent 2 hours and 20 minutes watching a video game. I don't know, but it came in the Aquaman sleeve. Nobody in this thing can act, but that doesn't matter. But I was stunned because it was directed by James Wan. And again, this $1.1 billion, huge hit. People loved it. So take it for what it's worth. But it's unbearable. It is just relentless and mind-numbing. And James Wan directed this. This is the man who directed the original Saw. He directed Insidious. He does the Conjuring movies, of which I am a big fan. Both of which star Patrick Wilson, who plays Aquaman's brother in this for no reason whatsoever. I mean, I both feel bad for him because he's a really reliable actor. I'm so good in the Fargo TV series, so good in Little Children. I thought he was great in Watchmen. But he's one of these guys that has never been a bankable star by virtue of, as an exemplar of that is the fact that I see him show up in Aquaman and I go, what's his name? And I have to look up his name, even though he's in so many things that I love him in. And,
right.
But he's so out of place in something like this. And I just feel he even seems unhappy about being there in the movie. But
that's his acting style.
But it was interesting that this is what James Wan's doing, and he brings Patrick Wilson in, and good for them. But I'm watching it the same day that the real life Lorraine Warren, the paranormal investigator on whom the Conjuring movies is based, died. So that was an interesting little connection. But so I'm obviously, I don't understand. I really don't understand why the hatred towards Holmes and Watson and why the love of Aquaman. I don't.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
Now we come down to superficials. I mean, Jason, that body, he hits the gym, that fella.
Okay.
I'm just saying.
God. Okay. This is the perfect time for us to play the closing music. This has been the end of when you start talking about men's bodies. I know it's time to say that you can find every installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at Blog Talk Radio. It will be available again at some point on chillpackhollywood.com. The site is there. We'll keep adding several shows each week.
Right.
And of course, they're available on iTunes, the 10 most recent episodes, and Stitcher.
And has our icon showed up? Did I do that right?
I don't know. I asked you. I'll look.
I got one that's showing it is, and then I got another computer that's showing it isn't.
So then I am both happy and sad for you, Dean.
Okay. All right. Work on it.
Have a safe trip to Warwick,
thank you,
Rhode Island. I will hear all about it next Monday.
Yes.
And
it'll be an exciting show.
And I will hear details that you don't even know you are conveying, because that's what happens to us when we lose our eyesight. Other senses become more sharp.
Wow, you're going to be the daredevil.
Until then, I would look dope with an all-white cane, I think. All right. And as long as I can see how I look with it, then I'll be fine.
Yeah,
all right.
Until
next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.